This evening, if we have opportunity, we will try to get through to chapter 23. So we start out with, I've wrestled with this through the years. Maybe you can look at it and see what you think. But you remember what happened with Abraham when he talked to God about Sodom?
He negotiated with God.
Okay, well, negotiated probably. He prayed to God that God would bless Sodom by, if he found 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. And what did God say? If I find 10,
I'll save
the whole city. But I'm not sure. I kind of think maybe that was similar to, remember Cain? When Cain killed Abel, what did God do?
He said, why has your countenance fallen?
No, I mean after he killed Abel. Did he kill him?
No,
but after Noah got off the ark, what did God say? Anyone who sheds man's blood,
his blood shall be shed.
And has that ever been changed?
No.
And it's still that way today. So it's possible that there's one of two things here. Either in this case, the lands that he's speaking about are much more wicked. But I doubt it, because was Sodom pretty bad? But anyway, what God reveals here is that if a land has sinned against me, we talked about this, the potter's field, but these are people who won't listen. If you look at verse 14 there, even if Job and Noah and Daniel were in that city, could they deliver the city? No, they would only deliver their own selves. So, as I say, I'm not sure if God has revised his teaching over what he did with Abraham. I guess revised isn't the right word, but crystallized, or man has had opportunity. But at any rate, three different times he speaks about four severe judgments. First is the pestilence. Then we have first isn't right. I'm looking for it on here, but I can't find it.
It says Ezekiel 14:12-23. It says the sword, the famine, the wild beast, and pestilence.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Maybe it's later, huh?
It's right on the first page.
Okay, that's okay, Laura. You gave them to us, so I can move on. Virgil?
Oh, okay. Could we pause just a minute on Abraham and the number of people, if they were found righteous, that God would spare?
Right.
I think there's I think you do to understand that there's a deeper and a broader subject and moral value that's being taught here. And that is that God rules in the nations. He knows. In my mind, he knew there was nobody there that was faithful.
Right.
That's why he set that judgment. But since the question came to him from Abraham, then he just went on down the list. Well, there wasn't anybody there, so the judgment was a righteous judgment.
Right.
That God.
And Sodom. I'm sorry.
And we see that throughout the scriptures, especially the Old Testament, where righteousness and people that are in step with the rules and with what God wants, that nation will either be used for something else that's good, but in any way, it's not going to take and receive the harsh judgment that God would place on a similar nation that is corrupt. Now, we can take and carry that same principle today. Our nation is headed in the wrong direction. And at some point in time, it seems like every nation, after a period of time, they fall from within through the moral corruption within that nation,
right,
brings that nation to its knees. During the beginning of just after the First World War, there was a statement that was made that it's a shame about the fall of France. And the answer to that was that it wasn't necessarily the fall. but that she was not fit to live.
Right.
And we need to pay attention to those things. Congregations, if the moral value of the congregation goes downhill, there's problems. In a family, the moral value of the family goes downhill, there's problems.
Right.
It's important that we understand these things.
Yeah, and that's essentially what he's teaching here, is that they've reached a level where I've decided to send these judgments. But the interesting thing, again, is that if these three men were in there, Noah, Daniel, and Job, could they deliver the city? Could they deliver the country? No.
No.
But did Lot deliver the country? I mean, he was the only one. Did he save his own soul? Yeah, so Lot ended up just like this. But this is an interesting thing to think about, because, as I've mentioned many times, if America falls, who's going to deliver their soul? People like Noah and Daniel and Job. And so if we're not like those people, what can we look forward to when a national judgment occurs? We won't be part of it. Because, as I've mentioned many times now, if you want God's providence working in your life, what do you have to do?
Be faithful.
You have to be a meat for the master's use and prepared for every good work by purging yourself, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting here also where it talks about, you know, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. And
right.
So we can also look forward to that. Doesn't matter how bad things get, we can deliver ourselves
right.
by our righteousness.
And he actually says in here, neither sons nor daughters. So if your dad's a good guy but you're not, is that going to help you? That's not going to help you. You have to personally be involved in this. So the next is the parable of the vine. And basically what God says in this passage is that there's many different kinds of trees. And each tree can be used to make beautiful furniture. But what can you do with a grapevine? What can you do with that little chunk of wood that we call a grapevine? And God says you can't do anything with it. You can't even make a peg from it. And then God says, what if we put it in the fire and we burn it halfway through and burn the ends? Now what's it good for? And then who does he compare this vine to? Okay, to Jerusalem and Judah. So they're of no use to me. I can't do anything with them. And this is something that we have to understand. God created the heavens and the earth for people to be used by him. And if they won't be used by him, he has no use for them. The next one is a parable of God's marriage to Jerusalem. And I say that because if you look at that very first verse there, it says, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations. But Jerusalem is symbolic of who? Because the city itself has no righteousness, unrighteousness, or anything. Who
God's
are we talking
people.
About? Okay, this is God's people. And he starts out, your father was an Amorite and your mother was a Hittite. Now, is that what Abraham and Sarah were? No. They came from where? Ur of the Chaldees. And they were from Shem. Who do these Hittites and Amorites come through?
Ham.
So what's God doing then? He's not talking literally here. But how did the Jews feel about the Hittites and the Amorites?
They were
a disgusting people. Unfortunately, Judah was now just like them. So your mother was, and he repeats this twice. He repeats this later in the parable too. So your mother's an Amorite and your mother's a Hittite, your father's an Amorite, and I found you laying in a field in your own blood. I found you as an infant child, and no one had cared for you at all. And so, verse 5 there, right at the bottom, no, I pitied you, nobody cared about you, nobody was going to help you, and so in compassion and in love, I reached down to work with you. And you grew and you matured and you became very, very beautiful. Now again, who are we talking about here? Cause who to know their abominations?
Jerusalem.
Okay, so we're talking about Jerusalem. So now, interestingly enough, the church is what today? Are we heavenly Jerusalem? So Jerusalem continued on. And unfortunately, there's a lot of churches today are running the same problem that that Israel did here. But so God swore an oath and entered. How many oaths did God make? You remember, what did God say to Abraham about his seed?
All the nations of the earth.
Okay. So can God ever, no matter what happens after that, can God nullify that covenant? No, because he made it to Abraham. Did Abraham violate the covenant?
No.
So that covenant remains fixed. So the people who came after, but God isn't, that isn't the only one he made a covenant with. What did he tell David? You will never lack
a man to sit on your throne.
Okay, and where's that throne going to be? In Jerusalem. Okay, that's why I say in the New Testament, in Hebrews chapter 12, you have come to Mount Zion, to heavenly Jerusalem. And in Philippians 3:20, our citizenship is where? In heaven. So we're citizens right now of heavenly Jerusalem. And all of these covenants that God made, the covenant he made with David, the covenant he made with Zion, he told the people that my temple will always be in Zion. Is it still in Zion? Yeah, it still is. Because God moved Zion from its symbolism, Hebrews chapters, 8 through 11, the symbolism of that first tabernacle and that first temple to heaven itself. And now Jesus is the high priest to the sanctuary that was built by God, not by man, that is, not of this creation. So everything God promised to Israel is still intact. Does David lack a man on the throne? No, but it's the same man, right? It's the same individual, and he's still reigning in Jerusalem over the people of Jerusalem. But it's all changed now. We're not talking about physical Jerusalem anymore. We're talking about all of God's people all over the world. We understand that with the body. We understand that with the shepherd and the sheep. We understand that with the husband and the wife. And we need to understand it about heavenly Jerusalem. We are citizens of heavenly Jerusalem. Anyway, so God says, I made covenants with you. Then if you look at that second verse on page 2, it says, I clothed you with embroidered cloth, put sandals of badger skin, put bracelets on your wrist, a chain on your neck, a jewel in your nose, and earrings in your ears. So we get a kind of a sense of what women liked to wear back then, right? And then fine linen and silk. So we dress pretty nicely. Yeah, so God, and verse 14, your fame went out among the nations because of your beauty, for it was perfect. Now, you remember when Solomon was reigning in Jerusalem? What did go out to all the nations? Why did the Queen of Sheba come?
For his wisdom.
She said, the half hasn't been told. Remember, she said, I didn't believe. But now that I've been here, the half hasn't been told of how amazing and wonderful you have made this city and your glory in this city. But then, verse 15, you trusted in your own beauty. You poured out your harlotry on everyone passing by. And you gave up your sons and your daughters to the fire, and you sacrificed them, and you didn't remember the days of your youth. You didn't appreciate what I did for you when you were in your youth. Now, do we see the same kind of thing in the New Testament? In Ephesians chapter 2, what were we in our trespasses and sins before God came along?
Dead.
We were dead. And God came along, and he found us, and he cleansed us, and he did exactly the same thing that is described here. And then, do some people forget the cleansing of their old sin and go back into the world? So, things are not different today. Now, in the middle of the page, you are not like a harlot. Why were they not like a harlot? What does a harlot want?
Money.
Well, what did Jerusalem do?
They wanted pleasure.
She paid them. She paid them to come in. Is that a different kind of a harlot?
Yeah.
God's just disgusted. He is so disgusted with it. So he says verse just, well, the one that says, they shall stone you with stones, thrust you through with swords, burn your houses with fire. verse 42, so I will lay to rest my fury toward you, and my jealousy shall depart, and I will be quiet and be angry no more. So this was the purpose for the destruction of Jerusalem right here. The children of Israel had bought and paid for this by the way they had treated God. And in, I think it's chapter 22, he says all the way back to Egypt. I learned something today I hadn't seen before. Did you know that God was going to destroy Israel while they were still in Egypt? We think about the first time after the golden calf. But God says here, I was going to destroy you in the midst of Egypt because of your idolatry, but because of my name, I didn't do it. And that kind of gives us a prerequisite here, because what does Moses try to use with the golden calf?
Same thing.
So this, it was not the first time. So it wasn't presumptuous of Moses to do that. He'd actually already heard that from God himself. All right, and we'll get to that in a minute. Now, in the very bottom of the page, in spite of all the things that Judah did, Jerusalem did, God says, I will remember my covenant. And I will establish an everlasting covenant with you. Now, when did God do that?
Then you'll remember.
Excuse me?
Then you'll remember it.
No, but when did he do it? When did he make this everlasting covenant?
Jesus got a new covenant.
Okay, with the coming of the church. God made everlasting covenant. Most of the covenants in the Old Testament are physical, right? But what about the one in Acts chapter 2?
Spiritual.
It's a spiritual covenant. It's an everlasting covenant. And he will never break it. Now, different individuals can lose it. But will God ever break this covenant with his church? With the Lord's church? No. The Lord's church, the difference in the Old Testament and the New Testament is outlined by by the Hebrew writer in chapter 8. He says, We will no more say, know the Lord, for all will know me from the least to the greatest. So how is that possible, that they will all know him from the least to the greatest? What do you have to do to enter the kingdom?
Choose.
You have to believe and be baptized, right? You have to hear the gospel. You don't get into the kingdom. You can't be a citizen. You don't enter the covenant. There's no reason for Christians to teach their neighbors to know the Lord. Why? They already do, right? They already do. So, and that's what we found in Acts chapter 2. Those people that came into the church, did the apostles have to teach them to know the Lord? No, because they had to know the Lord before they ever came into the church. So, verse 61, I will remember your ways. No, you will remember your ways and be ashamed. You shall know that I am the Lord. Then look at 63. Remember and be ashamed and never open your mouth anymore because of your shame when I provide an atonement for all you have done. Now, this is a prophecy of the church. And this is not, I don't believe this is simply a prophecy of the Jews who came into the church. What about us? Should we ever lose our humility? Should we ever lose our sense of shame at what we did before we became a gospel, or before we became a Christian? Should we ever look back on that and say, well, it wasn't so bad. Matter of fact, there was a lot of fun back there. Should we think like that?
No.
And we should be humble. You will never open your mouth anymore because of your shame. Now, this is the humility that God wants us to have, and the recognition that God wants us to have that we, without him, nothing. All right, let's go ahead and move to the next page. Now we have a riddle and a parable. God calls them both. In verse 2 there, you see underneath it says, Son of man, pose a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel. What's the difference between a riddle and a parable? Okay, all right. So in a riddle, you have to unravel it, right? But what's the difference between that and the parables? Do we have to unravel some of those parables? They're not just laying on the ground. Remember what Jesus said, seeing they will not see and hearing they will not hear. That's why I speak to them in parables, so that prophecy will be fulfilled. So pose a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel, and then it's about a great eagle. Now, this eagle flies to Mount Lebanon, and this eagle finds a beautiful, beautiful cedar tree, and he snips off the very top piece of it, and he brings it back, and he plants it, and it grows into a tree. But lo and behold, when another eagle comes along, what does the cedar tree do?
Bend.
Okay, it bends toward them. Now, who's the eagle in this parable, in this riddle? Well, God is. Who's the plant?
The house of Israel.
Well, Judah, the house of Israel, Jerusalem. And who are they bending to now? Even though God planted them, who are they bending to?
The other gods.
They're bending to other gods. So this parable of the eagle is a parable and a riddle. Look at the very last verse there. It says, he rebelled, sending ambassadors to Egypt. Can he break a covenant and still be delivered? So this is a riddle and a parable regarding the people left in Jerusalem and the wickedness that they were still performing even after the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, the next one, the parable of the sour grapes, how many times have we covered this in the last few months? So we don't have to spend a lot of time on it. I just wanted it in here because other people are using this book. And so, but basically, Israel has coined a proverb to describe their current plight. And essentially, what the proverb is, you really can't see it in the first. It says, the fathers ate sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. But toward the end, when they say, your way is not fair, and God says, the soul that sins will die. So, who takes personal responsibility for their sin and their plight? Are we victims? We brought this on ourselves, right? There's not a single sin. Did anybody force you to be a sinner? Anybody put your hand behind your back and God force you to sin? No, we all chose sin. Now, some of us want to blame our environment. We want to blame our heredity. We want to blame it on the situations, the parents that we had. What does God say about all that? That doesn't matter a bit. What matters is your personal conduct in the present moment. And all that you've done in the past and all that your father has done in the past. Now, God tells them, you're not going to use this parable anymore. But it's still being used today by whom?
Catholics.
Okay, by the Catholics. And they're not the only ones who believe that we are born what?
Sinners.
We're born in sin. We're born totally depraved. Matter of fact, I think probably, what, 50% of the denominations believe that? Well, I guess it's only the denominations that practice infant baptism. So that would be, I believe, the Lutherans, the Episcopalians, the Catholics. And I'm not sure of any more. Anybody got another one?
Calvinism.
Excuse me?
Calvinism.
Does John Calvin require babies to be baptized?
Oh, I don't know about the baby.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. Because the problem with Calvinism is you don't know if you're saved or not until what?
Judgment.
No, not till judgment. Until God shows your what? Remember the tulip? Total depravity. Unconditional
irresistibly
what?
Drawn.
Well, unconditional election means what?
Yeah.
If I'm saved, it's nothing to do with me. And if I'm lost, it's nothing to do with me. And as Brian said, we need irresistible grace. We have to be drawn. If we're not drawn, so why would you baptize the babies? If you have to, you have to see if you're one of the elect first. So, but anyway, this proverb is a perfect proverb for inherited sin. There is no way we can inherit sin. God says all souls are mine, so they come from God's hand sinful?
No,
they come sinless. And then we choose to sin. Any questions on that? Okay, like I say, we've covered that a lot. I'm not going to spend much time on it. The chapter 20 is an account of the history of Israel. These chapters are very fascinating. I would recommend that you read through them because there's a lot of information that I'm skipping over. But I just wanted to get the gist of it. But God gives an account of the history of Israel. He starts with the covenant. He starts with Israel. And so this actually starts with the children of Israel are coming to inquire of Ezekiel, and God says, should I be inquired of them? Make them know their sins and the sins of their fathers. And then it's that's exactly what he says there. Make known to them the abominations of their fathers. Say to them, on the day when I chose Israel and raised my hand in an oath. Then he goes on to say, I raised my hand in an oath, and I told you to put away the abominations which are before your eyes, and do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. So what's the time stamp here if we're in Egypt? What covenant is he talking about? Did God promise to deliver the children of Israel and to fulfill the covenant of Abraham and bring them and make them a great nation? Yeah. But then here's the point that I was making earlier in verse 8. They rebelled against me and would not obey me. They did not all cast away the abominations which were before their eyes, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury on them and fulfill my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. Now again, where do we find that in Exodus? The first time we see God's anger at Israel is when they go through the Red Sea and they're grumbling and complaining about the water. And then God becomes angry, and it's not until the golden calf that God says, I'm casting these people off. I'm going to start over with you, Moses. But apparently something happened in Egypt when Moses came to them at some point during those plagues where God told them, you see it in verse 8, that they were to put away the abominations which were before their eyes, but they did not forsake the idols of Egypt. And so then God said, I will pour out my fury on them and fulfill my anger against them in the midst of Egypt. But I acted for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned before the Gentiles among whom they were, in whose sight I had made myself known to them, to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So again, we have a time stamp. At what point in God's contest with Pharaoh are we when this occurred? See, at verse 9, it already says, in whose sight I had made myself known to them. Now, when did God do that? When did God make himself known to Pharaoh? Remember, Moses and Aaron come before God? Come before Pharaoh? And they say what?
Let my people go.
Let my people go. And Pharaoh says, I'm not going to do that. So what does Moses do with his staff?
Throws it down.
He puts it on the ground. He also, what does he do with his hand?
Puts it in his
leper. Puts it in and comes back out a leper. And then he makes water into blood. So at some point in here, God's already decreed to Pharaoh, these are my people. What if God destroyed them in Egypt after that? What would the Gentiles be thinking?
God's not very powerful.
Yeah, this would not go to the glory of God. So, again, interesting information here that we would not have known about except that God reveals it here in Ezekiel many, many years later, that he was tempted by something the Israelites did. Even during the midst of the 10 plagues, he was prepared to destroy them, but what held him back was his name's sake. It wasn't mercy, it wasn't compassion. Why did God hold back? Because he didn't want you and I to think he didn't have power. He needed to fulfill all of these plagues so that, what would we know?
God rules in the kingdoms of men.
Okay, God rules in the kingdoms of men. God can use any power he wants, and he can deliver his people. If Moses and Aaron had come out of there alone because God killed all the rest of them, what would we learn? It would have been a very different history of the Jewish people. So, okay. Now, the next one is called the Parable of a Fire. And I put in Jerusalem in question because we don't really know. It just says the land of the south. But since he follows it with a terrible indictment of Jerusalem, most people think it's probably Jerusalem. But God is going to kindle a fire. And look at verse 49, very top of the page. What are the people saying about Ezekiel?
Speaks parables.
He speaks in parables. So are they impressed? You know, we'll get to this. I think it's in 35 or 34. It says there, you're like a beautiful song to them. And they come to you like my people, and they come and listen to you like my people. But guess what? They don't do it. You're just a beautiful song to them. They say and do not. And this is a problem, I guess, that all preachers face. That people talk about, boy, that was a good lesson. But if you don't go home and do anything, was it a good lesson? It was entertaining. Boy, you can make the hour go by real quick. Is that the purpose of a preacher, to make the hour go by real quick? Carl?
It was a good lesson. Their ears were just wax squirrels.
Well, that's true. That's true. Everything Ezekiel did, was it inspired? Yeah, so if they were complaining, who are they complaining about? All right, so, but here again, Ezekiel is teaching them in parables. We don't find this a lot. Matter of fact, I'm not sure that this isn't the first time that we've had parable after parable after parable after riddle after parable after parable. Isaiah doesn't do that to the degree that he does. All right, then he has some prophecies of the destruction of Jerusalem. He says that right now Nebuchadnezzar is standing between two roads. And he's looking at the liver and he's shaking the arrows. Why is he doing that? It's called divination. What does divination mean? What? Divination. You're seeking the future from what?
Witchcraft.
Okay, from idols. It's witchcraft. That's exactly right. So Nebuchadnezzar, but who's going to make those arrows come out the way that he wants them to? See, God is. So, but there's two things that he does. First of all, he says, sigh with a breaking heart. And when they ask you, why are you sighing, you will answer them, because of the news, every heart will melt, all hands will be feeble, every spirit will faint, and the knees will be as weak as water. Hadn't come yet, but it's coming. Then there's a second sign, and that is, put a sign out of the, I don't know if this is out of the city or what, it says, make a sign and put it at the head of the road to the city. For the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the road, at the fork of the two roads, to use divination. He shakes the arrows. He consults the images. He looks at the liver. In his right hand is the divination for Jerusalem. And where's he going? That's where he's going. He's right on the verge. Now, the next point that he makes, I think, is fascinating, especially in light of what he just told Ezekiel a few chapters ago about Job, Noah, and Daniel delivering their own selves. He says right here, I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me. Now, what does it mean to make a wall and stand in the gap? What do we need here? Who stands between God and the sinners? Who do we need to stand between God and the sinners?
Jesus.
A mediator, right? A mediator. So I sought for a man who would make a wall and stand in the gap on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it, but I couldn't find one. Therefore I poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. Now, in chapter 23, we have three things occurring. First of all, there's another parable so similar to 16, I didn't even deal with it, about two harlots, Samaria and Jerusalem. But then we have the parable of the cooking pot. He goes out and he buys the choicest meat and he makes a beautiful stew and he spices it. And just as it's ready to eat, what does God tell him to do?
Throw it in the fire.
Dump it in the fire and burn it up. Then what do you do with the pot? Put the pot back on the fire. What if you put an empty pot on the fire? What's going to happen pretty quickly? It's going to burn up. And that's exactly what God says to do. And guess what the application is? Okay, it's talking about Jerusalem. Then God does something that I'm not sure we've ever seen it before or since. This is the very last verse. It says, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from you the desire of your eyes with one stroke, Yet you shall neither mourn nor weep, nor shall your tears run down. Sigh in silence, make no mourning for the dead. Bind your turban on your head and put your sandals on your feet. Do not cover your lips. Do not eat man's bread of sorrow. So I spoke to the people in the morning, and at evening my wife died. And the next morning I did as I was commanded. And the people said to me, will you not tell us what these things signify? And what they signified was, you're about to go through exactly the same thing when you hear about the destruction of Jerusalem. But would that be kind of hard to bear? I mean, after he says, I'm going to take away the delight of your eyes, he sends them out to preach, knowing what? I mean, if you knew your wife's going to die very quickly, what would you want to do? Yeah, you want to spend the day with her. What happened? He couldn't. He went out and preached. Now, I'm not saying he may not have known it was going to happen that day, but it wouldn't have made any difference because God told him to go preach and he couldn't spend any time with his wife. And then that night, she dies. Now, does that mean God killed her? Could God know she was going to die anyway and this is what he decided to use? So don't think like that. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there. And then next week, we're going to look at 34, 35, and 36. And we're going to spend the whole class on those. And then we'll be done with the book of Ezekiel. I don't think we're going to spend a lot of time on that picture of Jerusalem that he re-gives at the last, I think it's the last eight chapters. We have a picture of what nobody knows what it is, unless it's the church. All right, let's go ahead and stop there. Thanks.